I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Officials at the University of Missouri must be pleased that freshman enrollment numbers are up, finally, but not everything is rosy in the Show Me State when it comes to higher ed. Today we sit down with the chairman of the Board of Curators, the man who oversees the governing body of the UM system. We'll ask about the direction of Missouri's public universities. Then, as the average American gets older and lives longer, our need for geriatricians increases. Problem is, there aren't enough doctors specializing in elder health care to do the job. So how do we prepare the healthcare workforce to deal with the growing number of older patients? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. The University of Missouri system, and maybe most specifically the University of Missouri-Columbia, has had its shares of ups and downs since the student protests of 2015. But David Steelman, who's chairman of the University of Missouri System Board of Curators, which oversees campuses in Columbia, St. Louis, Rolla, and here in Kansas City, insists the system these days is on the upswing. Much of that, he says, is based on leaders now running the system. Steelman has said, top to bottom, this is the best leadership we've ever had, and leadership matters. David Steelman has long ties to Missouri politics. He was elected to the Missouri House back in 1978 and came within a whisker of winning Attorney General in 1992, losing to a guy named Jay Nixon. His father, Dorman Steelman, served as a state rep and a judge. His wife, Sarah Steelman, served as a state senator and state treasurer. She's now the commissioner of the Office of Administration in Jeff City. David Steelman, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Well, great to be back. I haven't seen you for a while, Steve.
It's been too long.
I feel like we've known each other for quite a while.
For a very long time, David. And I should point out that I teach up on the hill here at UMKC, and that the system, University of Missouri, holds the license for UMKC, for KCUR here. I've read that after you lost to Jay Nixon, David, in that very contentious race of 92 that only I and three other people around the state still recall, that you and Governor Nixon became good friends. How did that come about?
Well, it wasn't that hard. You know, it's interesting. This shows you how much politics has changed. We thought, and everybody around thought, we had a very contentious race. In fact, it was so contentious that the Libertarian candidate set an all-time record at the time, because I think nobody liked Jay or I when it was done. But we really became friends pretty fast, because it was different than today's kill or be killed. We didn't ever consider each other enemies, but we did become friends over the years. And the reason I'm sitting here today is he, in fact, appointed me to the board. I will add a funny thing. After 2015, I saw him at a social event, and I said, I thought we were friends, but obviously you're still mad at me.
Because he appointed you to the Board of Curators.
Yeah,
there you
but
go.
But it worked out great.
Well, and one thing about being a member of the board is, you know, it's a kind of a high-profile job, a little glamorous. It's a whole lot of work, though, right?
No, it used to be considered, I think, one of the plum appointments. It is a lot of work. As chairman, I spend more than 40 hours a week on it as chairman.
More than 40 hours a week.
And that comes to people as they rotate through. I will say, I wouldn't consider it necessarily fun, because there's a lot of hard decisions and it matters to the state. I've considered it one of the most rewarding things I have ever done. Mm. I have felt like this is more rewarding than my time in other offices.
No kidding.
Just, well, and
rewarding,
the students
why?
Are great. Well, one, everybody at the university, even those that you're fighting tooth and toenail to get to change, are smart people, and they're interesting people, and they're good people. We have great people at the university. And you meet these students at commencement and things like that. What we do matters, and I'll be giving a speech to the board on Friday where we've got some statistics which really also point out how much the university matters to the state of Missouri, mm-hmm. in workforce development, in economic development, and we've got a lot of work to do.
So has the University of Missouri, speaking of a lot of work, has it completed its recovery from the 2015 student protests?
Yes, basically. The only thing is the financial hit we took when enrollment went down, which I think was just because of a failure to grab control of the narrative. It never was what you were reading it was.
In what way?
Well, I went out to the tent city. There were 15 students out there. Nobody was ever in danger. I had two students on the campus. Mm-hmm. But there were media outlets, particularly in the East Coast, which wanted to say, see, this proves that Missouri, there in the middle of the country, has a problem with race. And there were people who reacted to it on the other side of the aisle who would act like we're being controlled by a bunch of leftists. And mm-hmm. none of those narratives were accurate. But it hurt the university in enrollment. And that dollar loss is still working through the system, and we're almost over it. I will say this, though. As far as the rest of the university, morale has never been higher. And I've been watching the university for 40-some years. We've got great leaders. I feel the university's in the strongest position to actually take off and improve as it ever has. We've dug ourselves in a bit of a hole, but that's not from 2015. That's over the last 20 or 25 years. This university and this state has not made some of the investments that should have been made in higher education.
You think the General Assembly should be putting more money into higher education,
well,
David?
Let me, again, that is an interesting question because it is more complex. We just got back from a trip to Arizona State, and they decided we're going to be more entrepreneurial. We are going to generate the resources it takes to educate and provide job opportunities, whether or not the General Assembly has.
We're going to generate the money internally.
Exactly. So yeah. Would I like to see more investment by the General Assembly? Yes. But I believe that the university has an obligation through matters like online resources, through intellectual property, through our health care systems in both Kansas City and Columbia to generate revenue. And, mm-hmm. and we can't just sit around and wait for the General Assembly. Now, I don't want to filibuster you, but we are also recognizing that dollars, public dollars, are under more demand than they have ever been. Medicaid mm-hmm. is just exploded. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not answering. But it hasn't left a lot of money for the investments that need to be made in higher ed. I don't know if you followed Moon Choi's last speech. We're going to make those investments. We're going to do it from reallocating money internally. We're going mm-hmm. to make some cuts. Some people are going to lose their jobs. There's going to be program cuts, but we're going to get the money now for the investments that this state needs.
You know, what's happened, and again, you're a longtime observer, a longtime follower of politics in Missouri. Back when I first began covering the General Assembly in the late 80s, you know, higher education had a certain respect, a veneer of respect around it. You don't get the sense it's the same today. What's happened?
Well, it's not nearly the same, but part of that has been the fault of higher education. One of the changes that Dr. Choi has made as president of the university is to reestablish trust with the people of Missouri, not just the legislators, but the people. It was easy for higher education to become insular. It was easy for higher education to forget who its customers were. It's mm-hmm. just business. Who are the customers? And higher education across the nation has paid for that. Now, while I say that is part of the problem, frankly, politics and politicians, being as they are, have tended to exacerbate the problem and misuse and mislead. And as a result, it's very important for us to get our message out.
I want to go back to the comment you made just a minute ago about new investments that the system wants to make internally here. You're talking about maybe layoffs. Where's that money going to come from? Explain that to me a little bit.
Well, one, we've got an administrative review, which we think can generate at least $50 million a year, maybe up to $80 million.
What does that mean, administrative review?
Well, and that is to go to some shared services. We have four campuses, four universities. Not everyone needs the same amount of HR. Not everyone needs an online campus. That could be centralized. There are a myriad of services that we can move into as shared services and save enormous amounts of money.
When do you want to see these things come online?
Well, we're doing them right now. I mean, they are happening right now. Mm-hmm. We are investing. I expect that we're going to make our first expenditure on the Translational Precision Medicine Center at this next board meeting, which is here in Kansas City, Thursday and Friday. That's going to be a $200 million investment for the state, not mm-hmm. just for the university. We have John Phillips, who's a curator from here in town, partner with Hush Blackwell, doing tremendous work to move online forward. And we've been having a series of meetings, and I think you're going to see online making tremendous changes this year. I think you're going to see some real investments in research made this year by looking at a program review. Not every program is as relevant to today's students as it was 50 years ago.
Right.
Yet some of them still exist.
Right.
That can't continue.
David Steelman is my guest. He's chairman of the University of Missouri System Board of Curators. Let's go back to those 2015 student protests. How did the university lose control of that narrative, to use your words? What happened there? Because student protests happen all the time.
I've said it. A campus without a protest is a pretty boring place to
be. Right.
We learned one hard lesson. Leadership matters. This is not to necessarily say that any of the people who mishandled this were bad people, but some of them, frankly, shouldn't have been in higher education. They didn't understand students. They didn't understand how to deal with these things in an open and transparent way, and that's how we lost control of the narrative. They did. Do you know, nobody said of our leaders, in fact, I think I was the first a year later to say, the University of Missouri is not a racist institution. Mm-hmm. But nobody said that because they just didn't understand the narrative. They didn't understand public relations. They didn't understand students. And it was just a bad thing.
Let's go to the good news, what's happening around the system right now. That this year's freshman class of, 4,700 students is up more than 13% from a year ago. You know that number. But overall campus enrollment is still dropping in Columbia. And, David, the percentage of African-American students enrolling at Mizzou has actually dropped in the wake of 2015 from 7.2% of enrollment that year to 6.7% in 2017. How do you size all of that up?
Well, that's the problems working their way through the system. Remember, not just 4 years, but five-year graduation rates. Actually, our African-American enrollment was up among this freshman class.
In the freshman class,
yeah, so that is the result. As I said, the media, many in the media tried to cover this. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I think, was particularly bad, I'm going to use the word bad, at trying to sensationalize it and act like there was a racial problem. So obviously, we had problems attracting African-American students from St. Louis. But mm-hmm. I believe that has now been fully handled.
But still, even those numbers are far below what the state percentage is for African-Americans in Missouri. Why has it been such a tough sell?
One, we haven't had enough of a program. I will say that one thing is going to make a difference. Because of the tight finances, we didn't have good scholarship programs. We've now started a year or so ago a scholarship program that all Pell Grant eligible students can attend Missouri for just the Pell Grant. In mm-hmm. other words, they don't have to pay anything out of pocket for tuition. We have high achieving scholarships to where they can get room and board paid too. So a lot of it was just a enrollment management plan that really wasn't geared at the financial help that it's necessary for the underserved communities.
If our listeners have questions for David Steelman, again, who heads the Board of Curators for the University of Missouri, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, one of the concerns the students, protesting students mentioned in 2015, David, was the concern over the dearth of Black faculty members. You look at the percentages of Black faculty members today, they've inched up only from 2.8% in 2015 to 3.3% in 2017. Again, that was one of the big concerns of the protesters. Why not more progress there?
Well, let me say, first of all, I agree with the student protesters. I met with them. That is an issue that I agree completely with. I talked to African-American students, and it really came home to me how important it is, not just for the African-American students, but for all the students to see a diverse group of people in leadership positions. So I believe that is a problem in higher ed in particular. The issue is that and this is not a good enough answer, we need to devote more resources to it. It is very difficult to hire and retain those great African-American professors. We just lost Stephanie Shanakon, one of the true leaders on our campus, just a lovely person, extraordinarily talented person, to the University of Massachusetts because they paid more money. So we are really working hard at that. I know that's not a good enough answer. That's not a good enough answer for a lot of the curators, including me, and to the students. We're working at it very hard. We need to get the resources, hopefully through this reallocation, and devote more resources to that.
I mean, 3.3% of your faculty, that's a hard number.
Well, it is, but I think we're more than a lot of the surrounding states. Keep in mind, too, a couple or 3 years ago, there was one African-American PhD in physics. Now, mm-hmm. How are you going to hire more African-American faculty when there's only one PhD in physics? We simply must make more progress, but it is a very difficult
issue.
To
what extent does Mizzou have a problem, David? Again, I'm talking about the campus in Columbia, just with its location alone. I mean, it's in the middle of the state. It's not in a major city. The world seems to be gravitating towards larger cities. Do you have a fundamental location problem, a geographical issue?
I don't think so at all. People like to say that. I don't want to embarrass this, but I will tell you the Attorney General of Illinois is African American, and I think he's going to be the next U.S. Senator. And his daughter is going to be attending the University of Missouri at Columbia.
Oh, really?
So I believe that when we do what we need to market ourselves and attract students, that they and I've talked to the groups too. The University of Missouri at Columbia campus is just such a beautiful place, and we just have to work harder and have a better plan. But I don't think it's necessarily a disadvantage.
A publication called Inside Higher Ed just took a long look at the Columbia campus and concluded with this, David. So where exactly does that leave the University of Missouri in 2018? Even with new leaders, it remains a public lightning rod, even after a slate of policy changes and new attention paid to student concerns. Some still wonder how much has truly changed, how much it is turning the page versus papering over issues. What do you say to that?
Well, if you'd have heard my interview, it was a very combative interview, which is why I'm not quoted very often because—
Well, you were in there a little bit.
Like you and I have talked about what's happening to reporting today. There are good reporters and there are bad reporters, but everything seems to be geared to getting attention. And I believe that reporter had his story in mind and simply went about cherry-picking what he wanted to cherry-pick to write that story. It's totally bogus. Do we have work to do? Yes, we. But so does every university in this nation, and so heck, so does the nation have a lot of work to do on this mm-hmm. issue. And so the reason we're a lightning rod is because he wanted to use the University of Missouri to be a lightning rod. But we feel good about where we are. But again, not to say that we don't have a lot of work to do. But I think it's reflective of the country as a whole.
You still have a relatively new leader, and you've mentioned Moon Choi to us several times here. He's the system president. You just extended his contract by 2 years to June of 2024. Why did you do it?
Well, because he's done everything we ask him to do and more. He has instilled a sense of urgency, which is not easy to do in higher education for change.
Why is that? Why is higher education, that's been an observation I would make, too, that it's not set up to move quickly and respond rapidly. Why is that?
Well, one, we're going to have to change. I mean, a lot of people in higher education or in the academy in particular will say, well, we've been this way for 1,000 years. But, eventually the Roman Empire lasted 500 years, but eventually it ended. So and I think our leaders understand we have to get more to the speed of the modern world. But tradition is a big deal here. The tenure process has, I think, bled over into other areas. I believe academics should have control of their teaching and of the academy and of their research. Somehow we allowed it to bleed over into budget issues and matters like this, which I think has caused more slowdown. But Moon Choi read this quote by Mark Twain at the last meeting that the less use a tradition has, the more fondly it's held on to. And I think that is true of higher ed.
Is tenure, the tenure system in higher education, David, is that proven to be more of a problem than an asset?
No, I don't believe so. I believe in the tenure system for higher education. I believe, though, it should go back to what it was meant to be,
which was to
allow professors to control their teaching and their research, allow them to teach the truth as they saw it, and to through research obtain the true information that may not be popular. I don't believe it has anything to do with setting the budget. I don't believe it has anything to do with the administration. I don't believe it has anything to do with trying to run students off of the University of Missouri campus during the protests. And I love our faculty, but the faculty needs to be better faculty and let the executive level do their job.
But you're very bullish on Moon Choi as the leader of the University
of Missouri. I can't tell you. We are so lucky to have him. I'm not just saying this as hyperbole. By the time we're done, I think he will be known right up there with people like Michael Crow at Arizona State or Mitch Daniels at Purdue or Bob Zimmerman at University of Chicago as one of the truly great higher education leaders in this country. And I hope he stays here at Missouri for a long time.
He wants to instill a sense of urgency. What else is he doing that has you so high on him?
Well, trust. It has amazed onlookers how fast the university has reestablished trust with the citizens and with the legislature. And frankly, there have been a lot of people helping, but that's been spearheaded by Moon. Moon Choi works 60, 70, 80 hours a week doing what he has to do to have the trust of Missouri, and has just done a remarkable job.
The system was just forced to endure a series of these steep budget cuts, tens of millions of dollars. This came in an era when a lot of people regard higher ed as more crucial than ever. To what extent did the cuts set back the University of Missouri system, David?
Well, I can't say that we couldn't use more money, because we could. I think our faculty, particularly at Columbia, where we're competing with other AAU high research institutions, is below market, and we must bring it back. But some of these budget cuts were done in order to invest in areas of students, scholarships, hiring new faculty. To let you know, these same stories happen all the time. I mentioned Bob Zimmerman at University of Chicago. There were a lot of critical issues or articles and, in fact, student protests because he was making cuts, they thought, at the same time they were investing $1.5 billion in building. What he was doing was what we need to do. He was modernizing. He was reallocating funds. So what you read that's happened to us is not just cuts for the university, although there have been difficulties. We haven't recovered from the budget cuts following 2008, but there's other ways for us to make the money, and there's other ways to reallocate money, and so that's what we're doing.
You know, you were an early supporter of former Governor Eric Greitens, but he was tough on higher education. What did you make of his performance in office and his approach to higher education in Missouri, David?
Well, look, I guess that proves that I'm fallible. what can I say? I made a mistake. His approach to higher education was particularly aggravating to me.
And he had a wife, has a wife, who teaches at the University of Missouri in Columbia.
Who I hope we can keep. She's one of the leading authorities on North Korea in the country. So I hope we can keep her. But I want the listeners here probably are aware of what happened with the conservatory, which is which I'd be happy to explain.
I was going to ask you about it.
Well, let's talk about that.
This is the proposed downtown music conservatory
that's right.
For UMKC. That's the governor vetoed funding for that. It may now be built closer to the Volcker campus here.
Do we have? Because I think it's important to go through that with a little bit of detail. I don't want to filibuster. What happened with the conservatory and the downtown arts, which was a great idea when it was proposed first in 2005? After 2008, and this campus at UMKC had some fiscal problems, there are a lot of questions whether it really met our strategic needs. We need, it was for 467 students as it was originally proposed. It was, even if the money was given to UMKC, it was going to require $2.5 million a year to maintain. At the same time, we're trying to fight back from a $10 million deficit. We simply didn't have the money. And so and the university failed to be open and transparent with the donors and with the people of Kansas City because we needed to have something that would get more students going to the UMKC campus. I think that is what this community needs out of its university more than anything. So we made a hard decision at the board. Even after the funding was there, we recognized that we didn't have the money to keep it open. We couldn't just do it for 467 students. We had other needs. And then, this is where I'm getting, and then the governor issued his veto, which was the right thing to do. And this horrible press release. Do you remember it? He talked about dance halls. So this makes a point about
the dancers and musicians.
It was just horrible.
Yeah.
So here's the point I'm trying to make about Governor Greitens' administration. We had a legitimate reason for doing it. He had a legitimate opportunity to explain to the people of Kansas City and Missouri what we were doing and why we were doing it, and instead opted for some cheap political rhetoric about dance halls.
Right.
It was a disaster for UMKC. It hurt higher education in this state because this community has great donors who are very involved in the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I'm summing that up to just say that that was one of many unforced errors by the Greitens administration.
So what's your hope for the new music conservatory at UMKC going forward now? What do you hope happens?
Well, we need it, first of all. I mean, that is something that is really needed. The dance and the theater here are outstanding. They are building blocks that we can build on that serve not only the campus but serve the community. And it really makes sense that I hope that we go with one of these proposals close to campus. And let me explain that. I'm a big believer in the Kansas City region. I think there are tremendous things happening. I love the can-do attitude. I compare, you all may write and cover about some governing issues and fights, but if you follow what's happening on the other side of the state, this has really been a solid, unified governing voice.
A lot of momentum in this town
between
right now.
Business, Mayor Sly James. I mean, it's been, and so, but what this community needs is a vibrant and active university. I don't see how that comes to fruition without 2,500 more undergraduate students, maybe 5,000 undergraduate students really needed, because then you get the mass that can keep attracting people. And so I believe that the conservatory and theater close or on the campus can provide that sort of lift that we need, along with other strategies that Dr. Agrawal, by the way, is already putting into place.
We're at, 15, 17,000 students on campus.
But most of those
now
are graduate. See?
Okay. And you want to see the undergraduate total pop up 4,000 or 5,000 more, it sounds like.
I believe at 5,000 more, we would become one of the leading, what I call urban institutions like Cincinnati, Louisville, et cetera, in the Midwest.
How do you get 5,000 more, David?
Well, you sell them. I mean, that's what it is. You got to have a product to sell them. I mean, that's why I think the basketball program, which has not gone well, but I think it's important. That's why it's important to have that arts, I think, on the university campus. We've got new scholarships. Dr. Agrawal, who you told me you haven't met, you're going to be blown away.
Yeah, he'll be here next week on the show. Yeah.
The people of Kansas City, the community, are so lucky to have him here. I don't know how we got him here. He is just fabulous. And he is going to build something that attracts and keeps undergraduate students. And that's going to help the whole that's going to make the university more successful. It's going to make the community more successful.
Well, that's David Steelman. He, again, is the chairman of the University of Missouri Board of Curators. David, it's been great to have you here. Thanks for your insights. I sure appreciate it.
Steve, it's great to see you again.
Yes, you bet. Coming up, a break, and then when we come back, how to treat, do we have enough doctors to handle the aging population in this country? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, the status of health care in Kansas. What would expanding Medicaid mean for the people who live there? Find out at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, what does the recent trend of redevelopment on Truce mean for those already living in the area? We'll look at a corridor near 31st Street that is undergoing some major changes. Join us tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, according to Pew Research, in 2016, there were 74 million baby boomers. Those are persons born between 1945 and 64 alive in this country. Combine that many people with a life expectancy of almost 80. And one question worth asking is this: are there enough doctors to care for an aging population and the health problems they encounter? As part of our continuing series on health, today we take a look at geriatric medicine, the specialty that focuses on high-quality, person-centered care of older people. To help us with that is Dr. Mandy Segal. She's an associate professor of medicine at Florida Atlantic University's Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine, a board-certified geriatrician, and a member of the American Geriatric Society. She joins us now by Skype from her office at FAU. And Dr. Segal, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
How many practicing geriatricians are there in this country right now?
So, you know, geriatricians, as you mentioned, are physician experts. We're experts in managing complexity of care, caring for older adults with advanced illness, with a focus on person-centered care and shared decision-making. And we make up an elite workforce. So in the United States currently, there are about 7,200 board-certified geriatricians, and we're working hard to empower our healthcare workforce, physicians in every specialty, nurses, social workers, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, pharmacy case managers, you know, the entire healthcare team to understand how to learn how to care for older adults.
But given the
geriatrics,
given the boom in the baby boomers, then is that enough doctors? Is that enough geriatricians, doctor?
You know, it's unfortunately, the answer to that question is no. And that's, again, why we're working so hard to empower our entire workforce to recognize the importance of caring for older adults. And here at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine at FAU, we're one of the few medical schools in the country that has a longitudinal curriculum in geriatrics, which means that in every course at our school, we have meaningful content in caring for older adults so that our medical students, regardless of the specialty they choose, are going to be knowledgeable about the unique nuances of caring for older adults.
You know, to your point, you say it's not just increasing the number of doctors in the specialty. You say it's preparing the entire healthcare workforce to work with older patients. And I'm wondering, how do you do that?
That's a great question. How do you do that? You do that through curriculum development at the very beginning of medical school and other health professional schools. You do that through interprofessional education, of having groups of students that are from different professions. So within the health profession, so medical students, nursing students, social work students, et cetera, work together to care for older adults, to learn what it's like to care for older adults in real practice.
I'm just wondering, you know, nothing against your specialty, but why do we need geriatricians to begin with? I mean, can't I keep going to my internist or family practitioner and I'll be just fine?
Sure. You know, and I'm a proud family physician, but our bodies change over time and our healthcare needs need to adapt with us. Geriatrics is a specialty that's focused on high quality person-centered care that we all need as we age. The high quality care truly aims to improve our health and independence and quality of life. Geriatricians are physicians that are experts at managing complexity and the advanced diseases that people have as they age. We really focus on function, improving function and improving quality of life.
Dr. Mandy Segal is my guest. She's a Florida Atlantic University professor and board certified geriatrician. How much additional training is needed to become a board certified doctor in geriatric medicine?
Sure. So after 4 years of medical school, someone would want to complete either 3 years of either family medicine or internal medicine residency training, and then 1 to 2 years of geriatric fellowship training after that. And then we can sit for our geriatric boards, which is an exam that we take to be board certified.
That's almost a decade of training, doctor. That's a long time.
I love school. What can I say?
You have to love school, I guess, to become a geriatrician. You know, you admit that geriatrics isn't a sexy specialty, but you picked it, and I'm wondering why. What do you like about it?
You know, I think that I love my job, and I feel very fortunate to be able to say that. I picked geriatrics when I was in residency. I looked around at my patient panel and realized that the majority of my patients were older adults and their families that I was taking care of. I truly enjoy the privilege of being invited into somebody's life and listening to their personal story, who they are, what shaped them, what they're worried about. And that relationship building, that rapport building, is what drew me to geriatrics.
In your opinion, what particular skills does a geriatrician need?
So I truly believe that if you are someone who enjoys complexity and working with others to solve problems, if you have a great ability to listen and to see the person as a whole person, to be able to collaborate not only with our patients, but their families and their caregivers, and the ability to empathize, those are the things that make a good geriatrician. You know, we don't have procedures per se. We don't have a cardiac catheterization or colonoscopy that we're going to do. We have the tremendous ability and the privilege to listen and to care for our patients and their family and meet them where they are in their disease process and with their concerns, and to work with them to see them as a whole person, and to work with them to share in the decision making with them to help them have the best quality of life.
How old do I have to be to get an appointment with you, doctor?
geriatrics is defined as anyone who's over the age of 65. But truly, I think that, people sometimes take issue with that. But I think as older people's conditions cause frailty, if you're managing multiple chronic illnesses, generally speaking, we see folks who are 65 and older, but our average age is about 75.
I was going to say, by the time someone comes to see you, they have, a lifetime of living already, and I imagine quite a few have long medical histories as well.
Absolutely. And that's what's fun, right? It's that managing of complexity. And I often tell my patients that we're here together now in this moment, and that I'm a really smart person, and I don't know what has happened at the beginning of their life, and I need them to help me fill that in. But we can work together to make sure that the rest of their life and our time together is meaningful.
You teach something called the Big Ten Basic Principles of Geriatrics, compiled by Emory University. And number one cannot be said often enough, and it's this: aging is not a disease. Why is it important for doctors to realize that when dealing with older patients?
Simply stated, aging isn't a disease. And I think that it's incredibly important for everyone to recognize that. I mean, it's every single day that I have a patient or a family member come to tell me that they felt dismissed by a physician because they went in with a concern that was a true concern for them, and their doctor dismissed them because of their age. And that's not appropriate. That's never appropriate. Every concern needs to be heard and validated by every patient, regardless of age.
Do doctors sometimes have to remind themselves? I mean, do you recommend that their patients who are aging, they're not facing a disease?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why we work so hard to teach those Big Ten principles here at FAU to all of our medical students. It's very important to remember that you're taking care of, and you're privileged to take care of the person who's sitting in front of you. As a person, not as their disease process.
You go to number 10 of those basic principles and you get this: ethical issues and end-of-life care are critical aspects of the practice of geriatrics. I mean, in geriatrics, you can't really shy away from the likelihood that you're going to outlive your patients. When it comes to talking about dying with your patients, what thought do you keep uppermost in your mind as you deal with them?
For again, a good listening ear, and to talk with them about the fact that the object of hope changes with time, and to ask them how they would like the rest of their story to play out, and those are the critical, crucial conversations that we have with our patients, and the crucial, critical conversations that we teach our students to have with their future patients as well.
You've talked any number of times here this morning about the importance of listening, doctor, and I always thought these days that doctors don't have time to listen. They got too many patients they got to go see.
That's absolutely true, but it can't be overstated that listening is critical and important. It's nothing for me to have patients waiting in the waiting room. However, and a lot of people, often object to that, but they also know that if they're coming to see me, that when they're seeing me, they're going to get my full and undivided attention. And that takes time.
How did you get involved with the practice of geriatrics? Where did that come from in your life?
So, if you talk to many geriatricians, there's often a link back to a family member, an older adult family member who was beloved. And for me, that was my grandparents. In my culture, I'm East Indian, and in my culture, we respect and revere our elders. And I had wonderful relationships with my maternal grandparents. And that led me to a career in geriatrics.
What kind of health care have they received over the years? What's been your sense?
It's, you know, unfortunately, it's been fragmented. They lived in Europe and they were part of the national healthcare system, so they had great care there. And then when they moved to the United States, their healthcare became fragmented. And I was so grateful to have my expertise so that I could get on the phone with their physicians and help to coordinate their care.
What's the most common problem that older folks tend to have? Does it fall into one kind of category that you might point to, doctor?
So, you know, we talk about geriatric syndromes, and these are the syndromes or disease processes that can occur as we age. There are several. And, you know, they're not necessarily unique to older adults, but they happen with more frequently, as we age. So things like falls, things like frailty, depression due to social isolation, dementia, cognitive impairment. Polypharmacy, which is the doctor way of saying multiple medications. Those are several of the more prominent conditions that happen as we age.
Well, here's one. Me and my buddies, we're all in our 60s now. And one of them sat down next to me on Saturday afternoon. We were having a beer over in Westport, a district here in town. And he sat down.
I know Westport.
Oh, there you go. Okay. He sat down, he looked at me, and he said, "Are you having trouble remembering things that you just did a few minutes ago?" And I'm wondering, how common is that among people who are in their 60s and are looking back now on long careers?
You know, I think that if you have trouble recalling things that were just said to you, but then can recall them with cueing, if you will. So you take a minute, you pause, and you remember it. That we consider normal aging. If you are having difficulty remembering where you put your keys, for instance, but you can remember them after a few minutes, that we consider normal aging and is relatively common as we age. It's common as we are so distracted in our lives. But if you're putting your keys in the freezer and your ice cream in the closet, you know, that is something that we would want to be concerned about. Now, that's a dramatic example, but, you know, that's one example of when we would want to be more concerned about memory. But we often talk to patients and their families about their concerns. And, you know, being repetitive with storytelling is another indicator that there may be something going on. Forgetting names of people that you know and have known for many years is another.
But sort of short term, where did I leave my keys? I don't remember what I, you know, did a couple hours ago. You can think about it. If you really focus on it for a while, it comes back to your mind. But otherwise, you're saying you wouldn't be too concerned about this.
Correct. I mean, but you know, if you are concerned, you should definitely seek an evaluation from your primary care doctor or your local friendly geriatrician to look into your memory concerns.
I want to touch on one more of the big 10 principles that we talked about before, and that is the importance of number 5 on the list. Social history, social support, and patient preferences are essential aspects of managing geriatric patients. I know what medical history is, but explain what social history is and why it's so important.
Absolutely. Social history is my favorite part of talking to patients. It's learning about their stories. It's learning about their lives. Who are they and what makes them tick? You know, in medical school, many physicians learn that as, do you smoke? How much alcohol do you drink? Do you do any illicit drugs? But it's so much more than that. It's, are you married? How many children do you have? What did you do for work? What are your hobbies? What do you love to do now? What do you do all day? You know, tell me about what you want to do. What are your hopes? Those are the things that make up the social history, in addition to, you know, have you smoked ever? How much alcohol do you consume?
Right.
And those types of things.
You know, a lot of folks these days, a lot of younger people live far away from their parents who are hundreds of miles away from where they live. That certainly describes my situation with my own dad, who's up in Minnesota. When I talk with him by phone, you know, are there things I can bring into the conversation to, you know, to gauge how well he's doing physically? Because, you know, he's still pretty sharp, but is there something questions I can ask to look at other aspects of his well-being?
Sure, that's another great question. And you're right, you know, we live farther and further away from our families anymore, and I certainly do as well. My parents are in Alabama. I should give them a shout out right now. But the things that you can ask your dad over the phone are, you know, Dad, have you fallen in the last 6 months? Have you had a near miss where you've almost fallen? Dad, how many times have you forgotten to take your medicine this week? Not in a way in which you're wanting to make him feel defensive, but in a concerning way, in a way that lets him know that you're concerned and that you'd be there for him should he need you to be there for him, if that's the case.
And if he has fallen, what do I do with that?
Sure. You know, you then ask him, did you hurt yourself? What were the circumstances around your fall? And try to troubleshoot there. And then ask him to go see his physician to talk about his falls and to assess his fall risk. You can also ask his physician, if the falls are multiple, to order a home safety evaluation, which is where we engage our colleagues from physical and occupational therapy to come into people's homes and to evaluate their living space or their living environment to see if there are any fall risks that we can mitigate.
You know, I understand that some of your patients have taken a great interest in your life, doctor, especially your pregnancies. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I was really lucky to, as an attending, so a practicing physician, have wonderful relationships with my patients. And at the retirement communities that I was lucky to work at, when I was pregnant with both of my children, first in Cincinnati and then in Kansas City, I worked in Kansas City at KU for a short time. My patients adopted my unborn children, and that was lovely. They were always so concerned about me and my health and my welfare. And, you know, a certain set of my patients even threw me a baby shower after our babies were born.
No kidding.
It was love. Yeah, absolutely. It was wonderful to have those wonderful relationships. And I mean, what another wonderful reason to go into geriatrics is because of the relationships and the continuity that you get to build, not only with your patients, but their families and their caregivers.
I mean, you're supposed to be caring for them, Dr. Siegel.
I know. Yeah. I know. And it honestly works both ways. When you show somebody how much you care for them, and you truly care, and you truly are concerned for them in their lives, they show that back to you 100-fold.
Well, that's Dr. Mandy Segal. She's with Florida Atlantic University, and she's a board-certified geriatrician. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes with us today. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, the littlest humans have led us to be more accepting of scientific medicine and governmental advice. How babies made us modern. Next time on Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.